current state for Wednesday, the 5th, Ash Wednesday. President Obama's 2015 budget plan was a mixed bag for Michigan. This according to Marissa Schultz and David Shepherdson of the Detroit News DC Bureau today. The president's spending plan seeks to add $90 million for FRIB, the nuclear science facility here at Michigan State, which has everybody very nearby, very happy. But it would jeopardize up to 650 jobs at the Selfridge Air National Guard Base in Macomb County. It would cut $25 million for Great Lakes restoration projects. And it has no money for the customs plaza that's needed for the new Detroit River Bridge. Has anybody seen the bridge? So the Congress must approve the president's spending plan. Of course, we will continue to keep an eye on that. Welcome back to Current State. We're glad you're along with an intense pothole season beginning to unfold here in Michigan. Debate is intensifying over how to repair and better maintain state roads and highways. Republican Governor Rick Snyder has favored a longer-term comprehensive approach that would invest over $1 billion a year in the effort, but fellow Republicans in the legislature have withheld support for the tax and fee increases that would fund the governor's plan. Other states face similar log jams, but recently one overcame theirs. Last November, Pennsylvania officials, who faced many of the same issues we have in Michigan, passed a measure that injected just over $2 billion a year into its transportation system. Today, a Pennsylvania transportation official visiting Lansing will explain how that happened. We're pleased to welcome him to Current State now. Brad Mallory's Executive Deputy Secretary for Administration for PennDOT, the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation. And Mr. Mallory is addressing the County Road Association of Michigan today at the Best Western Plus on Lansing and South Cedar. Welcome to Lansing, Mr. Mallory.
It's good to be here, and thanks for having me.
Sure. We've been discussing road funding in Michigan for several years, at least. Was it a long, drawn-out situation in Pennsylvania as well?
It certainly was. We've been at it for about 3 years, and as you point out, the similarities between the two states in this regard are really quite remarkable.
You just heard a fairly stripped-down version of the debate here in Michigan. At the moment, it's largely about GOP unwillingness, Governor Snyder notwithstanding, to increase taxes and fees for a comprehensive fix. Was there a similar dynamic in Pennsylvania?
In fact, there was. Between our two chambers, the upper chamber, our state Senate, less so. But in our Pennsylvania House of Representatives with a Republican majority, there was, you know, enormous concern about this and debate back and forth and even some, you know, fairly hard feelings, I think, generated over time arising out of the debate. But we ultimately were able to break through that.
So you have a Republican governor, a Republican House. You're saying you have a Democratic majority Senate?
No, it's a Republican Senate as well,
oh.
But it wasn't an issue there. The Senate Republicans were, and for that matter, the Senate Democrats were broadly in favor of this action.
Okay, that is quite a similarity. Talk to us here. Walk us through, if you will, how you managed to get through this logjam.
Well, as to some of the similarities, as here, the industry. The Chamber of Commerce, I mean, how often does the Chamber of Commerce tell government that they need to raise taxes, you know?
Yeah.
But they did in Pennsylvania, and they did here because they understood that their ability to grow the economy of our respective states was going to be severely compromised if this didn't happen. They were all advocating for this, but I think really what happened was we were able to convince people that the price of doing nothing was actually higher than the price of fixing the problem.
Right.
And, you know, and a winter like this, in some respects, for all the hardship, for all the expense, helps us refocus, I think, on the realities of our infrastructure because it makes us look at it and say, you know, we can fill potholes from now until doomsday, and that patch can blow out later at any time, or we can fix the road. So that over the longer term, it's much more resistant to deterioration. If you don't have enough money, all you can do is patch. If you've got enough money, you can fix it. And then you don't have the delays, the detours, the suspension problems, the tire problems, and the expense. And in reality, you know, paying some more, perhaps at the in a gasoline tax or a driver or vehicle fee, is one, it's predictable, and in the longer term, we believe it's significantly less than the cost of doing nothing.
Mm-hmm. Well, Governor Snyder has made that very point on many occasions. I'd like to go through some of the key components of your state's transportation spending agreement. Mm-hmm. Again, the similarities are quite surprising. You hiked license and registration fees, which Governor Snyder put on the table here. The legislature here didn't like that. How did you round up the votes for that? Was that a matter of what you just referred to? Just eventually enough legislators being persuaded that the costs really made sense, that it was a price worth paying?
I think so. And they were beginning to see, you know, in Pennsylvania we have a particular bridge problem. The state owned 25,000 bridges. And, you know, with chronic underfunding over time, the condition of those bridges was deteriorating. Now, frankly, there was a massive rebuilding bridge program in Pennsylvania, but even that couldn't keep up with the deterioration because of the age of our structures, which, once again, I'll bet the age profile is very similar to that here.
Mm-hmm.
So it became necessary, and I know some people, I'm sure, thought this was some kind of political ploy. It wasn't. It was just the engineering numbers. The condition of our bridges began to deteriorate to the point where we had to post and load restrict more of them. That is to say, a heavy vehicle can no longer go across this bridge. And in some instances, that literally meant that not only, you know, could not a semi-trailer go across, but it might have been that the fire truck, you know, had to take a detour, you know, to get across, where
right.
they previously could have crossed that bridge. Now, I will tell you, at that point in time, obviously, people start to think about, whoa, this is serious. It has a real effect, and there are consequences to inaction. So these actions, and I just got to say this, I mean, in this day and age, you couldn't get away with trying to engineer this stuff. The data is available, and people call you out, and they should. But the data were quite clear. You had to do this. So as we restricted more and more, we did about 1,000 bridges of our 25,000 bridges, frankly, we were still being very liberal by other state standards, but that really got a lot of people's attention. And ultimately, I think they made a political decision. The Democrats decided, listen, you know, we're going to call a Christmas truce here, and we'll get back at the governor, you know, tomorrow on everything else he wants to do. And the Republicans said, you know, he's our governor, and we need to support this, and we need to get this done. And our people are suffering because of it. Let's get it done.
So Governor Tom Corbett was an advocate of a larger, more comprehensive approach.
He absolutely was.
Yeah.
In his budget address about a year ago, he proposed a package of roughly $1.8 billion of additional investment. Actually, our Senate, based on some earlier studies that had been done, said, well, the number's more like $2.5 billion. And then that debate ensued. And over time and through the legislative process, the number got up to about between $2.3 and $2.4 billion by the fifth year. And I want to stress that because they phased most of these things in. Because although it might be cheaper than doing nothing, still, this is money out of people's pockets ultimately. You know, and they wanted to soften the blow and let people build up to it and accommodate it. And I think that was the right thing to do.
I just, for our listeners' sake, I'd just like to run through a few more of the components of the Pennsylvania agreement here. You did end up limiting the prevailing wage on smaller highway projects, which did upset some number of Democrats.
Yeah, it's very true, but interestingly enough, our labor unions, about half of them supported the package even with that inclusion, and about, candidly, half of them didn't. And the reason those that supported it did was because these were very minor projects. You know, they didn't involve, frankly, a lot of labor anyway, and the candidly, the work that their union brothers gained
outweighed
upside yeah. far outweighed this the diminution. But I'll be very candid with you. It made many of the Republicans in the House feel much better about the package.
I'm
because
sure.
this is a reform that they've sought for a long, long time.
I'm sure. So there was a compromise there.
Exactly.
You raised speed limits, correct?
Well, that was kind of a last-minute thing that came out of our Senate. What they did was include a provision that in certain rural areas of the state, after study, we could raise the speed limit from 65 to 70. And that's still unfolding as to how that's going to play out. To be quite candid with you, I don't think that that inclusion played a big role in getting it passed. I don't think it probably scared anybody away either. I think that was just kind of an add-on feature of the legislation, if you we could call it that.
We're talking with Brad Mallory. Brad is the Executive Deputy Secretary for Administration for PennDOT, the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation, and his state last November overcame a lot of the same hurdles that we face here in Michigan with regard to road and transportation funding. I also notice here, Brad, your state lifted the cap on wholesale gas prices. Has that had an upward and as much upward momentum on the price of gasoline as was feared at the time?
Hard to say. Let me explain that. As you correctly point out, the tax in Pennsylvania is assessed at the distribution level. There actually was, before this act, still 12 cents left that were directly imposed at the pump. This act took those 12 cents off and put them back at the wholesale level. And then on January 1 of this year, effectively, because it's a percentage, but effectively added the equivalent of about 9 cents a gallon to that wholesale tax, or the oil company franchise tax, as it's called in Pennsylvania, at the distribution level. Now, the question is, how much of it did they pass through? And there's been a vigorous debate among the industry people and the government insiders on this point, frankly, not so much outside or among people who don't. The price of gasoline is so erratic, of course, it's difficult to read it. But
a year ago,
Pennsylvania's gas prices were about 20 cents higher than the national average. They always have been, at least for the last decade. And we're about 20 cents higher than the national average today. Does that mean none of it got passed through? I don't think so at all. I'm sure some of it, maybe even most of it, got passed through. But we honestly don't know. And you really can't quite put your finger on it, but we assume that, you know, the distributors are going to pass through as much of it as they can.
Was the in the end, Brad Mallory, was the Pennsylvania legislative process politics as usual just harder, or was the process itself different in some way?
I would say it's the same process, and I'd be surprised if it was a different process here. And you know, people want to do the right thing. They want to solve problems. They want to fix things. And sometimes it's very hard to do because of competing interests, because people are very skeptical, I think, as we all know, about government spending in general. And they're afraid that, you know, the money won't get spent for what it was intended for, or won't produce what it was supposed to produce.
Right.
And, you know, and people got to work through all of that, and they should. I mean, it shouldn't be easy to take more money from people. You know, it ought to be hard. And it was, but I think it was the normal political process. I think over time, people just finally came to the realization they had to do something. And persistence, you know, we were at this for 3 full years at least.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the previous governor, a Democrat, Ed Rendell, had argued persuasively for some years that something needed to be done, but he just couldn't get traction. So we've been at this for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I would say to the folks here that just persist, keep looking for the right solution for Michigan, and it'll be different than it was for Pennsylvania, I'm sure. Keep looking for the right solution, they'll find it eventually, and they'll be the better for it.
Brad Mallory is the Executive Deputy Secretary for Administration at PennDOT, the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation. He's in Lansing as we speak, about to address the County Road Association of Michigan today at the Best Western Plus in Lansing. Thanks, Mr. Mallory.
Thank you.
Current State on WKAR. Welcome back. It's Wednesday. It's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, when we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature the Listening Ear. I'm sure you're familiar with it, a Lansing-based all-volunteer organization that boasts the longest-running crisis hotline in the nation. Here to tell us more, Steve Bond. For going on 35 years, he's been the Listening Ear's longest-serving volunteer. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Mark.
And joining him is another volunteer, Tanya Bareness. Welcome to Current State, Tanya. Tanya.
Good morning.
So the longest, I've heard this periodically over the years, the longest running crisis hotline in the country. That is really an amazing little fact to have in your corner. Tell us about the more distant history of the Listening Ear, Steve. How did it get started?
Well, it was started in 1969. A graduate student at MSU, June Jacobson, was talking with her graduate advisor, Dozier Thornton, about the unrest that was going on in the East Lansing MSU campus. And they had heard about the start of crisis intervention centers in California. And we were really the first crisis center outside of California. The city of East Lansing and MSU got into a partnership, and they formed a committee to see if there was a need, found a small space on Grand River to open up. We were actually on the second floor of Grand River for a long time. They said if we got 1,000 calls in the first 3 months that there would be a need, that would show a need for the community. They got 1,000 in the first month of service in 1969. Mm.
As someone who grew up very nearby and then attended MSU, the photograph on your website of your original location you just referred to, 547 and a half East Grand River, really brought back a flood of memories. I also remember reading your announcements for several years on campus radio station here at Michigan State at Brody Hall. Tanya, tell us about the services that you offer.
Some of the services that we offer are counseling services, walk-ins. We accept those. We have a section of sexual assault counseling as well. And we also do a lot of referrals. If people need community referrals elsewhere, we do offer those services as well.
Mm-hmm. Community education is part of what you offer as well, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how does that unfold?
Well, so we have one of our volunteers also fields calls that if someone wants a speaker to come and talk about crisis intervention. We are trained in suicide prevention, and so we'll go out and do talks to high school groups or local civic groups. One of the biggest things we do is we are in collaboration with the MSU sexual assault program. We do a Take Back the Night in April, which is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and that's part of our community education group.
How many calls do you get?
We still get about 1,000 calls a month, so that averages out to about 35 a day. We're open 24/7, so we're available when other social service agencies are closed. CMH oftentimes will refer people who call their line. If they don't need medications or hospitalizations, they'll refer them to us if they just need a listening ear to talk to.
And most of these calls come from the Tri-County area or where?
You know, most of them were from the Tri-County area. We find with the advent of cell phones and cell phone plans that we get calls from all over the country now. People find us on the website, and we get calls from California and Virginia. But mostly still, we're very much a Tri-County area agency, and most of our calls still come from the Tri-County.
Tanya, do you have a story that kind of captures why you do what you do at the Listening Ear? Maybe a particularly memorable call?
Just in general, I guess I would say talking to people who have been depressed and feeling that I can be there for them. Because I've been depressed myself, and I've been in that place. And I being sympathetic towards them and empathizing with them in their feelings and normalizing it for them. And just overall being there for them and being that ear, that someone that they can talk to in that moment of crisis that they need.
It sounds like it's potentially stressful work, though, for non-professionals. How does that play out?
Well, so we definitely rely on each other for emotional support. We find that the 65-hour training program we put people through really does prepare them for work on the phones, but to sustain that work, we really rely on each other. And because we're an all-volunteer group, nobody's there because they have to be there. Everybody wants to be helpful. And I find the staff really helpful to each other. It's a really...
So you lend a listening ear to each other,
absolutely,
as well as to the outer world there. Where does your funding come from?
East Lansing provides us the bulk of our funding, and then we also get some money from the Ingham County Commissioners. And then we do various fundraisers. We do a couple of mailings. Tanya actually is involved in our 5K run, which will be in the fall, and she's the coordinator for that program.
Okay. How long have you been having the race? Good long time? More recent development?
No, it's about four years now. We're coming into the fifth year now.
Okay. So. And if people are interested in volunteering, you're having some upcoming orientations. Tell folks how the process works.
So you can either call us. Our number is 517-337-1717, or we're also online.
That hasn't changed since 1969,
has
it?
That has not changed. No. And we're also at theear.org, theear.org, and it has information on our orientations. We're doing a training this April, early part of April, so our orientations actually start next week. So this is a good time for people, if they're interested, they call and get some information about us.
And 65 hours is a significant amount of training. What happens in those 65 hours?
You learn skills on empathy, and just tap into in touch with yourself. You learn a lot of skills during those 65 hours of training.
People learn a lot more about themselves
yes.
Really in the process.
So we start out with a lot of small groups. There's some lectures. Like I said, the community mental health director comes and gives us a talk, and we have talks about suicide and sexual assault. But really the heart of the program is small group learning. People do role plays for each other, and then staff come in and do role plays for them to really prepare them for work on the phones.
Could you use more volunteers, Steve?
Yes, we could. Right now we're at about 60, and we'd like to get about 20 to 30 more people to really make the organization function smoothly.
Can they call the hotline for that, or do you recommend online or the website or what?
Any way you can get to us is
fine.
Matter. The hotline,
yeah. Somebody's always answering the phone,
that's
right?
That's right.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like tremendous, rewarding work, and I think a lot of people in the community are so proud of what you've accomplished there. We want to thank Steve Bond and Tanya Bareness, part of the Listening Ear, an all-volunteer organization based in Lansing that operates the longest-running crisis hotline in the country. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
And we're also quite pleased to take a moment to offer an update on one of our most memorable Neighbors in Action segments. Back in August, you might remember when Tashmika Torok came in to tell her very moving personal story and to talk about her new nonprofit, the Firecracker Foundation, which she was hoping would be able to provide therapy to survivors of child sexual trauma who could not afford it. Well, in a little over 6 months after its inception, the Firecracker Foundation recently announced that it's contracted with several therapists to provide comprehensive therapy to 10 young people in the Lansing area. And to that we say kudos, Tashmika Torok, and congratulations. Now, current state could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there that are doing excellent work, just like the Listening Ear and the Firecracker Foundation. We just don't know about them. Let us know about them. Tweet us your suggestions at KAR Current State or send us an email to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Michigan Political Leadership Program, or the MPLP, is a program designed to promote diversity and dialogue in how our communities, our state, and our nation are run. It started in 1992 and is administered by the MSU Institute for Public Policy and Social Research. Every year, 24 people from all over the state and across the political spectrum are chosen for the 10-month program. They develop skills to help them win elections and serve their constituents. The latest group has just started the program. Now, this week, the MPLP program holds its annual fundraising dinner Thursday night in Livonia, followed by a fundraising breakfast Friday morning in Grand Rapids. Their emphasis on spanning the political spectrum is embodied in this year's speakers, Republican former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty and former Democratic New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson. Joining us on Current State to tell us more about the Michigan Political Leadership Program are the director of the MSU Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, Doug Roberts. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mark.
And MPLP co-director Ann Mervin. Ann, welcome.
Good morning.
Why, Doug, tell us, why was the MPLP program started back in 92? You've been at it 22 years now. And by whom?
The MSU had the vision to basically believe that we could improve dialogue across the aisle. And so, therefore, in 1992, they began a program in which the 24 individuals, as you mentioned, would be selected. And we do select or try to select 12 individuals on one side, Republican, 12 individuals on the other side, Democrat. We sometimes have an independent or another party. But the whole idea is to not just train them in terms of being elected and the issues, but also to understand that you can disagree without being disagreeable and to actually be able to talk across the aisle.
Walk us through, Ann, walk us through how the program works on a month-by-month basis for our listeners. Describe some of the training for winning an election, for example.
Certainly. First, we have a media weekend, Mark, which you would enjoy, where the fellows learn to be interviewed on the radio. They learn how to be, they face actual Capitol reporters in a mock roundtable. They learn to make a 30-second television ad, and that preps them for the real-life activity, the activity that they'll undergo as a candidate. They write a campaign plan. What is their business plan, so to speak, to win an election, which includes fundraising, social media planning. So we give them tools that they need to be successful.
I have to assume, I know there's this bipartisan emphasis and thrust at the MPLP, but, I mean, your participants' politics are pretty much established when they walk in the door. Doug, do you see political opinions changing in the process of this?
To be very candid, I think Ann should answer that. She's there every single time that they meet. So, Ann, why don't you step in?
Sure. I don't see people changing their minds on issues, but what I do see is them having a greater understanding of the other side of the aisle. People come away with strong friendships. We have 14 members of the Michigan legislature now who've been former fellows, some of whom were in the same MPLP class together, and they can literally walk across the aisle and say, how is this going to impact your district in Detroit? I'm from Grand Rapids. I don't understand your district. And conversely, Detroiters have a greater understanding of rural Michigan and northern Michigan and west Michigan. So I don't see people changing their minds as much as being more understanding of each other's point of view.
Who does the training?
We use only practical trainers, people who in real life. So, for example, Dan Perot, former campaign manager and chief of staff to Governor John Engler, leads the workshop on campaign planning and development. It was John Engler's campaign plan that led him to victory in 1990. We use Democratic fundraisers, for example, and again, they're teaching Republicans as well, but it shows that people from both parties are engaged in a significant way at providing this leadership development.
Talk to us about tuition, Doug. Who pays the bills here?
The actual tuition is free. There is a fee, but it's more like room and board. We do ask the participants to pay $1,000, and that's really the cost of putting them up overnight and the food, but the actual tuition is free. And where we get the money from is that you mentioned it earlier. We have a dinner and a breakfast coming up. We raise money at that fundraiser. And I just want to point out that the dinner, we expect to have close to 800 for dinner. We expect to have between 300 and 400 for breakfast. These are some of the largest multi-partisan events in the whole state. And we're very proud to be part of it. And so I just think that just touting it, I'd also like to point out that Governor Bill Richardson, who you already mentioned, is one of our speakers. He was also a former UN ambassador. And given the events of today, he's just an ideal speaker to have at this time.
After 22 years, Ann, is there an MPLP brotherhood and sisterhood out there? I mean, do graduates of the program from the 90s, for example, are they staying connected with the program? Are they staying connected with other graduates, as far as you can tell?
Yes, they are. The friendships that they make during their 10 weekends together last a lifetime. Some, you know, lives change, so some people are more engaged than others. We have a regional alumni network so that alums can find each other through activities in Midland, for example, or in Grand Rapids, so they can cross boundaries from year to year, and in addition to staying in contact with their fellow classmates. The social media, Facebook, has really helped a lot in that regard.
We're talking with Doug Roberts and Ann Mervin of the Michigan Political Leadership Program here on Current State on WKAR. The MPLP claims to be the only program of its kind in the country. Doug, is that still true to your knowledge? And why haven't other states picked up on it, if so?
It's certainly one of a handful. There are programs that attempt to emulate our program, but I would argue that at the moment ours is still fairly unique. But there are programs that try to duplicate some of the things that we do. We're still, I think, the premier program of this nature in the country.
And if 45% of graduates have served or are serving, that still means more than half have not gone on to public service. What's happened to that other 55%? Do you know?
Well, yes. We try to track the activities of our graduates. Frankly, some one or two people will go through the program every year thinking they want to run for office, and they come out thinking, you know what, that's not really what I'm meant to do. I'm meant to actually work behind the scenes. So we have several fellows who are staffers in the Michigan legislature who end up running campaigns and elections rather than running for and holding office for themselves. So it becomes a lot of personal discernment about what their role in public life is. But I can assure you that well over 50%, probably close to 80%, are active in their communities on nonprofit boards and commerce and other community activities.
As both of you are our longtime political insiders here at the Capitol, I want to ask both of you just about the current atmosphere at the Capitol. Given the focus that you have on reaching across the aisle at the MPLP, are you seeing results from your work? I mean, I think the discord at the Capitol gets an awful lot of coverage. What do you make of that?
I will go first. I think there is a lot of discord at the Capitol, and the only evidence that I can present are the anecdotal stories that some of our graduates will at least come back and report. At least I know somebody I can go and talk to. And the number is 14. We're very proud of it. But at the same time, there's a lot of people in the legislature, and I would argue that that's the reason programs like this are needed now more than ever, because from my point of view, there is a great deal of discord, and we have to find a way in which we can talk across the aisle. Even if we don't agree, we can do it in a more agreeable way.
Ann, what do you think?
We've started in the last year what we call the Michigan Political Leadership Program Legislative Caucus. So our 14 members of the Michigan legislature meet every 3 months or so to talk about how they can work together, help support the program. And I agree with Doug. I think that we need this program more than ever. We have several candidates who are considering running for office. We'll know in the April 22nd filing deadline how many people we will have. But I think we'll have a significant number of people in addition to the 14 next year in the legislature.
Doug is a former state treasurer, and Ann, as a former Engler administration official, I'm sure our listeners would like to hear a few of your thoughts on the current administration and the legislature, especially here in an election year. Overall, Doug, give us your thoughts. What do you make of it?
Oh, I think that Michigan is sort of like the nation. We had a terrible economic downturn. We had a lot of problems with the auto sector. I think that clearly the state and the nation is on the mend. I think that we have every reason to be upbeat about the economy in Michigan. I wish I was more upbeat about the discourse. At that moment, I do think we're divided as a state in terms of where we would like to go in certain policies. But frankly, I am very upbeat at the moment, and I think the statistics are showing a steady improvement in Michigan.
And it's the Republicans are in charge downtown. What do you make of this legislature, this administration?
Well, I have to give Governor Rick Snyder a lot of credit because he has really taken on the issues facing our urban areas and strengthening them through the emergency management process. And I am, as someone who's lived in or around Detroit most of my life, I'm excited for the future of Detroit, and I give him a significant amount of credit for that. And you know, he and the legislature have worked very productively together. I think it's going to be an interesting year, but I'm anticipating, the House will pick up some Republican seats and the Senate will stay Republican moving forward.
Do you expect Rick Snyder to win a second term, Ann?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. What do you make of the Senate contest?
I have to give Carrie Land we'll see what happens with Obamacare and how that still continues to resonate. But the polling, both in Michigan and nationally, shows Republicans doing very well.
Doug, care to weigh in on the coming year?
I really can't disagree with what Ann said. And I choose not to make predictions in terms of what's going to happen. And so, but I can't really make a case against anything Ann said.
Given the role of the Michigan Political Leadership Program, I mean, the Michigan voters could face a ballot question this fall regarding a part-time legislature. Could I ask your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I personally will vote no. It's a much easier vote for me than one might think. I spent a lot of my time and life and working in state government. Even with the problems we have, you need, in my opinion, you need a full-time legislature to do nothing more than to keep track of what the executive does. We have a checks and balance system of government. I think it, over the long haul, has worked very well for this country, and I think you need a strong legislature to do a checks and balance with the executive branch.
MSU Institute for Public Policy and Social Research, Doug Roberts, and MPLP co-director Ann Mervin. Thanks to both of you, and good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The MPLP events with Bill Richardson and Tim Pawlenty are Thursday, 6 p.m. at the Laurel Manor in Livonia, and Friday morning at 7:30 at the Marriott in Grand Rapids. Current state on 90.5 WKAR, there are not a lot of hard-driving rock bands fronted by cellos, which is what makes the group Cello Fury so unique. The band out of Pittsburgh features three cellists and a drummer. Current state Scott Pohl spoke with the three cellists in the band, Nicole Myers, Simon Cummings, and Ben Munoz, about their early years.
I'd like to hear how you got started playing the cello.
We were lucky enough that we each had public school strings programs. So I started in the third grade, as did Simon, and Ben started in the fifth grade. And we each have different stories for choosing the cello. Ben, for example, his mother is a cellist, and so he kind of picked it up after watching her. Simon chose the cello because it was the biggest instrument offered, and that's what he wanted. And I heard a variety of string instruments, and I just fell in love with the sound of the cello. It appealed to me, and it was very musical and very soulful, and I immediately knew that that was the instrument for me.
I'm picturing the three of you as being kids taking cello lessons, and then after the lesson, putting in your earbuds and listening to rock and roll music, and that's how you came to love both. Is there any truth in that for you or for the others?
I didn't listen to a whole lot of popular rock bands growing up. I think I'm probably the most rooted in the classical tradition. I listen to a lot of classical music and some jazz, but I think I'm going to let you talk to Simon because he actually grew up listening to lots of different styles of music and started composing and playing in rock bands at an early age.
Well, my name is Simon Cumming from Cello Fury, and as far as the crossover aspect of rock meeting classical, when I was a little kid, that's definitely what I did. I would for sure go to my lessons and play Bach and Brahms and then go on the car ride home cranking out some metal or grunge or anything else that I listened to when I was a little kid, which was pretty heavy music for an 8 or 9 year old, but I think that's definitely rubbed off on our style, is like an early introduction to every kind of music, not just classical cello music. And that's basically how we turned our attention towards this style of music, is we all were influenced by different music growing up. We never just grew up in a classical household. And I kind of didn't really want to. I think I would have missed out incredibly on lots of great music if I had only heard Beethoven symphonies when I was a kid.
Yeah, this is Ben from Cello Fury. And when I started out playing cello, I had just music of all kinds kicking around. My mom was a cellist, and she really got me started in the beginning. But, you know, if I were not practicing or having a lesson, I'd be listening to, my father is still very into, you know, classical, Spanish music and world music. And then I'm naturally inclined towards progressive rock and metal. All music's connected because, you know, it's based on the same principles. And, I always like trying to find something in all kinds of music that I can, you know, I can relate to and respect.
I wanted to find out if Cello Fury is something of a side project for any of you, if you're playing with other groupings or maybe in an orchestra in the Pittsburgh area. Is Cello Fury something on the side for you guys or your main endeavor?
For all of us, our Cello Fury is the main focus, absolutely. And once in a while, we'll each be approached. We might be approached about a single cellist for a performance, and then depending on scheduling or whatever, maybe one of us will take that. Or we might do a chamber performance or something. But no, none of us have an orchestra job or play consistently with really any other groups in the Pittsburgh area. And you know, we're all really extremely focused and dedicated to making Cello Fury our primary job.
Was it hard to find a rock and roll drummer who wanted to play with three cellists?
That's an interesting question. We actually found our drummer through another performance I had with a singer-songwriter. Our drummer's name is David Throckmorton, and he plays with many different groups. He's primarily a jazz drummer, actually. He toured for several years with Maynard Ferguson, but he's very versatile, and he plays country and rock and jazz and hip-hop as well. And for him, because the songs are formatted like most rock songs, with the melodic line and harmonies and the rhythm and the bass line, it hasn't been very hard for him to just slip in and learn the music. So he feels, from what I've heard him say, he feels that it's pretty similar to playing in a regular rock band. And we love the fact that every time we play, he brings something different to the table. Our music for the three cellos is through composed, so it's written out in sheet music that we learn and practice and memorize. And when he comes in, he can stick to the basic format, time signature and the groove, but every time he plays, it's a little bit different. So it adds that unique element to every show.
Is all of your music original, or do you ever do rock cello versions of classical pieces or other covers?
I think that 98% of our music is original. The reason for that is, one, it's hard to find music written out for cellos. Even in the classical repertoire, there are some chamber music pieces for cellos, but not as many as, you know, you would find in a string quartet or for a piano trio. So when we got together initially, we did play some cover songs that we arranged ourselves. But we realized that we didn't want to just copy what other people were doing. We wanted to create our own music and create something new. So we took our training at the university studying classical music and knowledge of classical songwriting with knowledge of writing rock songs and put them together. And over the years, we've developed our own style that we call, instrumental progressive rock. Like I said, we want to create something new and different and sort of forge our own path rather than just playing other people's music. But occasionally, we do play a few cover songs at shows. People do like to hear music that they know, and that keeps it, you know, adds some variety to the sets as well.
I'm sure you're familiar with the group Two Cellos. They've done some recording. They've even been taken out on tour with Elton John. is the world big enough for two groups that are primarily made up of cellists?
I think the world is definitely big enough for cello-centered groups. It's a funny question because it's still unusual enough that it piques people's interest to have cellos being the forefront. But if you think about your typical rock band, how many rock bands throughout the world are able to play and make a living? And I find that of the few cello-centered groups that do exist, our styles are actually very different. And it's almost like comparing, like you mentioned, two cellos playing with Elton John. Elton John could be considered, you know, a rock musician, but yet his style is very different from a band like Metallica. Even though they have, you know, a singer and drums, and keyboard and guitars, it kind of branches out. And I think the more exposure people get to different styles of music, the more you'll be able to see that a group like Cello Fury features a cello but has a different sound than a group like Two Cellos.
I'm not sure there's been a big rock band that featured a cello really since the Electric Light Orchestra.
You know, we do, when we are describing our music to people who haven't heard it, many people do think about Electric Light Orchestra or Trans-Siberian Orchestra because it sort of has a similar style. And we like the fact that we are a little bit different from a traditional rock band, and we think that helps us appeal to more people and brings people who like to go to the symphony to our shows, but also people who like those bands and traditional rock music. So it helps us to reach a greater audience, having the cello be the forefront of the band.
I want to ask about your fan base, because I'm picturing your traditional classical music fans maybe not caring for this so much, and I'm also picturing rock music fans maybe not quite getting it. So I wonder who is getting Cello Fury?
I think we are lucky that we do have people who like classical music also like our music. There is enough tracks of our album that do just feature the cello. You can always hear that cello sound, that melodic sound. And when we play in traditional rock clubs and people see us, you know, go to the stage with cellos, they're a little bit quizzical at first, but after they hear it, we found that most people really get into it and just enjoy it for what it is, without any judgment. So I feel pretty lucky that we can appeal to lots of different people. We also work a lot with children and youth, and we do outreach concerts all the time, and we do summer camps where we show kids how you can play alternative strings and rock music on string instruments. And then we also have fans who are, you know, retired folks, and everybody in between. So a lot of people want to know what our target audience is, but I think we don't necessarily have one. We like to keep it a little bit more open, and appeal to as many different types of people as we can.
Cello Fury is Nicole Myers, Simon Cummings, and Ben Munoz with drummer David Throckmorton. They'll be playing at The Loft in Lansing on Thursday night. Doors open at 8. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us. We're really looking forward to the show.
Thanks for having us do the interview. We're really excited.
Hey, this has been Ben from Cello Fury, and it's really appreciative to be in the interview, and hopefully we'll see you at the show.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll speak with the new director of Prima Civitas, and we learn about the history of jazz in Detroit. That and more Thursday here on Current State. The executive producer of our program is Peter Wharf. Joel Instroth is the producer, thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Melissa Benmark, Scott Pohl, and Kevin Labry. Also to Aaron Young for engineering and Hannah Michaeljohn for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.